Blog Talk Radio.
Beanie, this is We Talk Productions, one of the few black-owned radio networks that explore solutions for issues in the black community. We sense black urban America. All you folks that may want to have a comment or ask a question, you may dial 516-531-9540 and press 1. Put some music on.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give you...
Sorry about that. We're talking about... talking to the guests and whatnot. On Tuesdays, on the second Tuesday of every month, we had Emma Young of Chicago. On the third Tuesday of every month, we had Bev Williams, the advocate of Milwaukee. And oh yeah, I'm your host. I'm Kenny Jones. On Saturday, we have Provocative Thought with Call to Sleep. Now, tonight, we have a professor on tonight that's going to be discussing academically gifted black males that try to change the narrative about black men. What is the narrative about the black man in America? How do America viewed the black man? And how do we view America? They always talk about negative images of the black man in America. There are black men in this country that work every day for their families, take care of their wives, their children, or they're business owners, or they're doing something in the community. But we always want to focus on the rapper, the drug dealer, the dropout, gangbanger. And so with other people, even Africans or Jamaicans or other blacks of Africans for the diaspora come over here, they have this negative perception of black men in America. But, and he explained how the educational system portrays this. He's an author of a book called Building on the Resilient Models Frameworks of Black Male Success Across the P-20 Pipeline. He is the professor and endowed chair of Prairie View. Welcome tonight on Black Urban America is Dr. Fred A. Bonner II. Welcome, Dr. Bonner.
Thank you, good sir. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you. I know you're a busy man. I'm not going to hold you too long tonight. I want to ask you a few questions. I think your topic and what you're working on out there in Texas. And let me tell you something. A lot of educators listen to my show all across the United States. They listen to the show. And so like you said, in your narrative, you know, these are frameworks for educators, community activists, people that work with black men. So let's open up. What is the education pipeline for black men today?
You kind of broke up a little bit. Could you say it one more time? What is the...
What is the educational pipeline for black men today? Describe it for me or for us.
All right, there we are. Okay, I apologize about that. So, you know, you said, what is the education?
Educational pipeline for black men today. Describe that for us.
Oh, absolutely. So, when you talk about the education pipeline, and what I try to impress upon people is that we actually have to think about education as a pipeline. Mm-hmm. And referred to in the literature as the P20 pipeline. And what we mean by that is that you have to focus on students in general, black males in particular, from pre-kindergarten all the way through 12th grade and then on into college and into career and professional training. So that's
yes.
That's the 20. So as we look at P12, we know that's
all. Because the 20 is the average age when they graduate from college.
Well, the 20 is really the level and the progression of their movement beyond high school. So P through 12, that's pre-kindergarten through 12th grade. But then
right.
When you say 14, 15, 16, you know, that's typically, 13, 14, 15, 16, that's typically your undergrad. And then mm-hmm. 17, 18, 19, 20 is if students choose to go to graduate school or to medical school, dental school. So the P20 pipeline is basically saying from pre-kindergarten all the way through graduate and professional schools, we have to look at education as a pipeline that carries across all those different gradations.
Mm. Why? This has been an issue, you know, for decades. Next question I'm about to ask you. Why do you think that the percentage of black males have a low efficiency in reading and a high rate of dropout?
Oh, that's a very good question. So
this was going on in my day, and I'll go back to the 70s.
Exactly. And, you know, that's a very good question. So when we look at proficiency in reading, proficiency in math and science, so I would say as we look at things like the National Assessment of Education Progress, NAEP data, we call that America's Report Card. So it gives you an assessment of how all students are doing in reading and literacy and in math and science. But particularly in the areas of reading and literacy, we see this severe gap and severe decline among our African-American populations in general, African-American male populations in particular. And I think some of that goes to how we are socialized, you know, the social and cultural capital that we provide to our children. And it's rich in the black community, but we have to be very, very concerned about what are those social and cultural capital. What are those markers? What are those things? What are those accoutrements that we're giving to our children? So as far as the social capital, you know, what are we doing? How are we training our children? What are we instilling in them? Are we giving them this mindset or this fervor for reading? You know, are we encouraging them, you know, instead of, you know, always turning on the TV or instead of always turning on that PlayStation, you know, are you reading a book? You know, how many books have you read? So do they see you reading? You know, are there books in the home?
I don't see too many kids reading books today, Dr. Bona.
Yes, sir. So, yeah. And, you know, I know. And for a lot of us, you know, even though for older folks, you know, a lot of us don't read like we should. But but I still
say let me ask you this. And I'm going to ask you a very, very serious, subjective question. I know professional black parents take education seriously. I know well-to-do black parents, families take education seriously. Do the regular, average black family take education seriously?
I think they do. I think taking education seriously is not something that is just specific to or endemic to a particular socioeconomic status. I think there are parents who have less financial resources, but they really take education seriously. Now, they may not be able to provide the resources to their children at the same level as the more affluent black parents, but just because you don't have the means and resources doesn't mean that you're not taking education seriously. So I think that we have serious parents who are low income, who maybe don't have the resources. We have some parents who are high income, and they don't use their resources wisely. Instead of buying that kid those tennis shoes or buying the kids those sneakers, you know, that cell phone, what about getting them, you know, some technology or laptop or some things that will help them in their educational pursuit. So from that, I don't think there's necessarily a socioeconomic scale that's tethered to seriousness with education. I think there are serious parents who are low income, serious parents who are middle income, and serious parents who are high income. But I think we really have to be concerned about what do we mean when we say serious about education? What does that mean?
What does it mean, doctor?
Well, I think being serious, and this is just my opinion, you know, but I think different people will define it different ways. So I think for me, being serious about education is that you're making an investment in ensuring that, you know, your children are progressing in those areas we just talked about, in reading and literacy. They're also progressing in math and science. And by progressing, I mean that they are actually not only on standardized test measures, not only on those things where we say that, you know, if you can finish this particular exam and make an A or make a B, that you've done well. But are they curious? Are they developing creativity? Are they developing their mind? So this reading, you're doing these readings, you're doing this, you have these books. So how does that enrich your thinking? Because some of the problems we see with kids nowadays, and even with adults, is that no one can engage in critical thinking. Critical thinking skills are tantamount. They are so important. So our students progressing in the literacy and the reading, and they're able to show up their critical thinking skills. And are they doing the same thing in math and science, showing up their critical thinking skills? My undergrad degree and my training, my first degree, my bachelor's degree is in chemistry. And I was always very, very inquisitive about, you know, science, about math. When I was in high school, I was a musician. I played piano. I played trombone. Both of my parents were athletes. So I was always exposed to a lot of different things that, you know, sparked my creativity, sparked my skills. And I come from a very, very, I guess I would say, middle-class family, so not a rich family, but I came from a family with parents who valued education and who valued me being inquisitive, being creative, and they tried to support my creativity.
Mm-hmm. What's some of your models that you speak about that can improve the path of the black male in schools?
Absolutely. That's a great question. So I have, there are a couple of models and frameworks, as I call it. And I actually have a book. It's called
Building on Resilience.
Yeah. Building on Resilience, Models and Frameworks of Black Male Success Across the P20 Pipeline. So So that's one of my volumes. And in that book, it is full of models for folks who are asking those very good questions, just like you're asking, you know, what are the models and what are the frameworks? So what I wanted to do was to have a collection of models and frameworks, not just mine, but colleagues who actually do this research on black males, who actually have these models on black males, who can help to inform how we think about black male achievement. But your question was, you know, what are my models? Well, one of my models, I have my own model. It's called the AGBME model, and that stands for academic. Yeah, so A is an apple, G is in go, B is in boy, M is in Michael, E is in egg. So the AGBME model, and that stands for academically gifted black
male.
Engagement.
And you know what? That last term, I have, like in the last 2 years, I have many teachers that come on the show as guests. And the main thing that I kind of catch them on near the end is the engagement process. Why?
Yeah.
Especially public schools. Now I can speak of public schools, okay? I can't really speak towards private schools. Why are the public school educational system, one, refuse to engage with black men, black males in the school system, two, misrepresentation, diagnose. I mean, like, why even today? Now, this has been going on for a long time. I can remember speaking about this in the 80s and 90s, how black males for behavioral issues thrown into special ed, and special ed is supposed to be for mental health disorders. Or they just want to separate us or discourage us, I'm sorry, this is supposed to be a question, discourage us from school. How come they don't want to engage the black man?
Yes, good question. I think there are a lot of reasons out there. So in some of my research and in some of my consulting, I spent a lot of time working with school districts, working with institutions of higher ed, particularly by way of institutions and programs and initiatives aimed at trying to improve the experiences and improve the connections with black male populations. And that question comes up a lot. And there are many reasons. They're multifarious. There are many, many reasons why I think. But let me just distill it down to a couple that I see to be the most pervasive. One of the major reasons, it's going to sound very simple, but it's very, very true, there is fear. There is fear of the unknown. So we know that our school systems are also very, very white and female, and we know our schools are also so very, very, many of them, black and male.
I found out 2 months ago, 72%, only 6% of the teachers are black folks in our schools. 6%.
Yes, when you look at,
I'm thinking like, okay, we're getting better. We got more black folks going into education. We got more black principals. I was naive on that fact. And I looked it up. Because, like I said, I always have educators come on the show. 6%.
Yep, and for black males, it's worse than that. For black males, it's less than 2%.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. I'm sorry to cut you off. Go ahead, Doc.
Oh, no, no. You're good. You're good.
So, it's
so,
the
yeah,
fear.
I mean,
especially Milwaukee. You got Milwaukee having problems. Oakland having problems. You have several mid-sized cities, as well as large cities, predominantly black cities, that are having very difficulties with blacks, specifically black men. You know, which to me, is a representation how black men are treated in society in American society. Because you talk about changing the narrative. We've been trying to change the narrative for over 300 years. How do young brothers, when they go on to school, higher learning, or they get a skill or whatever, how can they participate in changing the narrative of the perception of us?
Yes. So, good question. And exactly what you're talking about is what I attempt to do. You know, we talk about the predominant narrative, and we know the narrative about black males is what we call a deficit narrative. So we're looking at deficits, looking at what black males are not doing, how they're not successful, how they're not achieving. So what we have to do is change, and that's exactly why I focus most of my research on black males who are academically gifted and talented, because that starts right there from the very basis of my research. My decision not to focus on black males who are in these deficit-based positions or deficit-based perspectives that society tends to narrate, I have chosen to focus on black males who are academically gifted and talented to tell an asset-based model. So what we have to do is start to look at how can we change the narrative from deficits to assets. Well, you know, there are many ways, but one way that to do that is to talk about black males who are academically talented. So I want to talk about that brother who comes from that home, from that side of the tracks, from that socioeconomic status, but he's sitting in your class, in your physics class, with a 99.9 average. We never talk about that. Or to talk about that brother who comes from, you know, we talk about single-parent homes and talk about how the deficits from that perspective. But this brother who's coming from this single-parent home, who has this mother who's very, very supportive, and he's there in your calculus class, you know, scoring so high that he's
has the highest SAT score.
Exactly. So those are the students that we
recognize. The only time we get recognized is catching a football or shooting a basketball, and again entertaining the masses. Instead of, and I tell people all the time, you'd be surprised how many black inventors this country had. You know,
exactly.
How much stuff was in your house that was invented by black men. You'd be surprised.
Wow, that's true. That's true.
Yeah. And you talk about assets, you know. And another thing, wow, that's a great term you have. Go from deficits to assets. And I guess, you know, I was hearing this guy on his channel yesterday talk about media, how we portray. It appears they really want us to stay on the deficit side. That's how come they're always projecting images of us in prison, gangs, getting arrested, doing harmful things in the community, instead of focusing our attention on God graduating, opening up a medical clinic. There's three brothers in New Jersey that opened up a clinic like, what, eight years ago that came from the neighborhood. You know, information such as that. So, yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Doctor.
Oh, no, you're good. You're good. So, yeah, that's basically it. We just have to get out ahead of the narrative, you know, or get ahead of it when we can, or if it's one that's already out of the gate, we've got to find ways to corral it so we can tell a different story. So how do we, everything that we look at by way of the narrative that we can tell, you know, the research, I teach research methods courses, and one of the courses I teach
tough course,
is my dissertation.
Man. Tough course. Whew. That course gave me problems.
So, yeah, so one of the things in research I always tell students is that, you know, there are narratives, but we can always tell a counter-narrative. So, and our counter-narrative when it comes to black males should always be focused on assets, like I said, as opposed to looking at deficit black males in education. You know, how can we talk about those black males who are academically talented? Or as we talk about black males who are in different spheres, you know, how can we talk about those who are talented, who are doing well, as opposed to those who are having, you know, maladies and problems? So, again, it's really all about the core of how you frame the narrative. Are you framing the narrative from an asset perspective, or are you framing the narrative from a deficit-based perspective?
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you when I first started doing this research on black males, and it was a major shift for a lot of people to even think about. You know, they're like, well, why are you only focusing on high-achieving black males? Well, what about the black males who are struggling? I'm like, there's enough of that literature out there. I said, that's all we concentrate on. So I get it. I said, and I would never, you know, negate any brother, whether he's academically talented or academically struggling. But what I am saying is that the literature tends to only focus on those brothers who are academically struggling. And there are a whole bunch of brothers out here who are doing super, super well academically, and we need to focus on those brothers some of the time because that needs to also be the narrative.
And also, just to add, it demonstrates positive images of the black man. Because if you let other people tell our story, positive black men don't exist.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
No.
Absolutely.
What's growth producing? Growth producing.
Hey, Brother Jones, can you say it one more time?
What is growth producing?
Producing?
Yes.
When you say growth producing for just for black males in general or
in a
particular context?
Yes.
I would say growth producing, it really depends. At the K-12 level, I would say it's growth producing to have teachers and role models who are very invested in these black males' success. I think it's having mentors who one of my colleagues and fraternity brothers and friends, he's a scholar in this area as well, Dr. Gilman Whiting at Vanderbilt University. I share with you my AGBME model, but he has a model, SIM. the scholar identity model. Mm. And in his model, he says that you are not going to get black males to be successful until you first get them to see themselves as scholars. So the mentor, the teacher, the role model, you need to instill in them this mindset that they can be scholars. They need to own this notion of having a scholar identity. So once they own that scholar identity, then that's growth producing. So
how can we get these gifted brothers? Now, I'm always a big advocate of, even though you might live in a junior mansion or a mansion or a gated community or in a very upscale, diverse community, you should at least as a minimum, give a Saturday back to the old neighborhood, to a neighborhood that's underprivileged or not doing too well or what have you, providing workshops for single parents or parents or black fathers or black adolescents. And we're not talking about every day, every week. We're talking about a couple of hours a month. So people could see, say, okay, it could be done. Because see, when I was coming up, people didn't move out the neighborhood. You know, next door neighbor was a councilman. Up the block was a mailman or a cop. But these are all black men leaving their home, kissing their wives, you know, taking kids to school, drop them off or what have you. Yeah, we had some gangsters too and everything, but it was something about that village and everything. It wasn't until the crack epidemic that all those folks like the mailman, the cop, the councilman, the business owner moved out. And what was left, and when you move out, you take resources, you take the positive images. Like I'm 11 years old, and I said, wow, maybe one day I could be a coach or a teacher. We had a couple of teachers living around the corner from me. You know, and it was a upscale black community, it was just a regular black community with different income levels and different occupations living together. And it was nothing to see a pastor walking. Now all these pastors live on the outskirts, live in mansions and whatnot. So my question is, how can we get these gifted young black men, not young, but gifted black men, to come to their nearest black community, predominantly black community, that might not be doing so well, you know, and give back a little bit.
Exactly. And sometimes, you know, it's funny. I say a lot of times, you know, sometimes people look for a grandiose answer to that particular question, but I think sometimes it's just as simple as have you asked them?
Mm.
There are so many times when folks will say, you know, I would have done such and such and so, but nobody has ever asked me.
Yeah.
So
that's true too.
I know that, you know.
That's true too.
Yeah. So we have to, I do a lot of work. I do a lot of research. I'm called on to do a lot of consulting, but this has been true about me since I began in this career where I got to the point where I could do some consulting. I have always done more things for free than I've done things for pay.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I don't begrudge people for getting paid for what you do, but I have always believed in doing service, even before it was kind of a mandate with my job. I mean, faculty, we do teaching, research, and service. And I say to my colleagues all the time, I'm like, look, you should not be getting paid for everything. I mean, some things you should do just for service. I mean, was it Maya Angelou that said that, you know, your the ticket, your price you pay on this to be on this earth, to be on this planet is service.
Mm-hmm.
So we all should give service. And I know I do, and I know there are a lot of people out there. I'm not the only one.
I did. Because when I first started, I coached youth football, volunteer for 27 years. And when I started, one of my friends was at practice. He said, man, why are you doing this? I said, to keep young boys out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
To keep them out of prison. You know, using this. This is my contribution. I'm using this so I can have use this as a tool to show some illustration that they could use when they go home or when they interact with their parents or when they go to school or survival tools or what have you with their friends and whatnot. So I started coaching gangs who were just starting to come in on the East Coast and what have you. So, yeah, I think every young, I mean, young black women do it like nothing, like it's nothing, you know. I think. We had to get into the mindset. To me, this is only me. We got to get into the mindset that we have to give back. You know, we cannot wait on shootings. We cannot wait till bills being signed or have you. We got to be proactive on this. And your approaches and your methodology to focus. And see, if it was left up to me, every black man that get a college degree got to sign a contract to spend 2 hours a month in a black neighborhood. I don't care where you are. I know that'd be difficult to do, but that's something because a lot of these kids. A lot of these kids, all they see is the gang members and the hustlers. That's their world. Because some of them don't even go outside of their six-block radius community. But I'm from a large community, though.
Wow, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. I got one more thing. The action then I'm gonna let you go. How do you teach resilience?
You say how do you teach them?
Yeah, to be resilient.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So I think that the most important thing to understand about teaching black males, teaching our diverse communities, is to understand how they best learn and what is going to be the most effective teaching modalities to complement their learning styles. So with that said, there's a whole body of literature out there, and I talk a lot about it. I know a lot of my good friends and colleagues have written about it. We all talk about culturally specific pedagogy. Basically, we're saying that your teaching practices, your teaching styles, they should be culturally specific, and they should meet the preferred learning modalities that these students are bringing to the classroom. So my good friend and colleague and mentor, Dr. Donna Ford, who writes a lot about gifted black students in general, particularly about black males, she talks about how black students, all these different learning styles that we bring to the classroom that are also very, very unique and different than some white learners in the classroom. There's this term that, you know, may not have heard of, the listeners. It's called VERV. V is in Victor, E-R, V is in Victor, E. And what VERV is, basically, it is a learning modality that basically says that some students, particularly our black male students, they don't, the most effective learning for them doesn't come from them sitting in a desk and sitting in rows and sitting there for an entire hour while you lecture or while you teach. You have the black male that gets up. He wants to stand at the back of the room. He wants to, you know, he wants to sit on the floor. He wants to be in a different desk. He wants to stand for a while. He wants to move. So some teachers in places and spaces would see that as being disruptive, but the literature says that actually that's a form of learning, and many times it's a form of learning that's associated with gifted behaviors. Some of our brightest people on the planet, black, white, red, or green, are not people who always colored inside of the lines. Most of the times they were people who didn't.
Okay, Dr. Baum, I appreciate you coming on my show. And I mean, you really provide some valuable information. And I know I have to invite you back and lay on sometime this year. I know you're a very busy man and everything, but I appreciate you for taking time now and sharing this information with us.
I wouldn't have missed it for the world. You have a very important show, brother, and I appreciate all that you're doing for all of us, and particularly for our black males.
Yes, yes, yes. And it's hard work, too.
It is, but you know what? If anybody can handle it, you can. You are a warrior, and we love you for it.
Right. Thank you so much. Okay, folks, that's it for another week. This is Black Girl of America. Remember, I'm your host, Kenny Jones. As always, I am because we are. We are because I am. Good night.
Good night.
You will not be able to stay home, brother.